To normal people, the ideas of the woke crowd sound ridiculous. Common sense Americans just can't stop laughing at their strange worldview.
Feeling like trans people are a threat to you in a space like a bathroom or a locker room is actually a version of internalized misogyny.
Well, this question says, what do your students call you since you're non-binary? Miko's one of my students. What do you call me, Miko?
They, them.
So I need y'all to deconstruct the way a professional needs to look, because that's white capitalism.
I am a white, transmasculine, femme non-binary, disabled, neurodivergent, obsessive-compulsive, chronically ill, Unitarian Universalist, raised Jewish.
Their ideas may sound ridiculous, but is there anything dangerous about wokeness? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
We've all heard the term woke. It's the idea of being awakened to the alleged power white men have over other oppressed identity groups. The woke believe that being white carries an unjust privilege, and that white males keep their power by setting up systems that oppress so-called minorities. That is, black and brown people, gays, trans, Asians, indigenous, the hefty crowd, and the countless number of genders that make up each of those groups. They believe whites, and in particular white males, have set up systems to oppress them all. This woke group has some wacky ideas that sounds almost like satire.
I believe we should move beyond all meat. The assumption that the best protein comes from corpses is a racist belief. 21st century animal eating requires our complicity in a new colonialism. These events especially affect girls and young women. Your hamburger comes with a dose of misogyny. Meat eating is also one of the ways gender-based structures of oppression are perpetuated. Masculinity, a construct of the gender binary facing constant destabilization, feels always under threat, and eating animals is its protection racket. White supremacists weaponized it, eating meat, eggs, and dairy, and the baiting of liberal men as so-called soy boys are all part of the neo-Nazi messaging. I heard all your laughter. I know some of these must be new ideas, or you think they're fringe or whatever. Our whiteness is part of the problem of meat eating.
To many, wokeness is simply nonsense. But with the rise of this ideology seeming to spread throughout American institutions, it has common sense Americans wondering, is wokeness dangerous? To find the answer, we hear the story behind one of the most revealing experiments in modern times. And in the process, we learn how wokeness has massive implications on society at large.
We've all pulled different kinds of pranks in our lives. Sometimes little ones like TPing a friend's house. Other times, we might get a bit more elaborate. Maybe we set up a booby trap at home that surprises a loved one. Then there's a level of prank that very few have the gumption to pull off. The kind of prank that has the potential to embarrass a lot of very powerful people, and even expose a broken system. This last category is where we find a guy named James Lindsay. James is the purveyor of newdiscourses.com. His team planned an extraordinarily important hoax that had the potential to not only expose a broken sector of academia, but also reveal the true nature of wokeness. Their plan was elaborate, so much so that they had to commit at least a year to executing it successfully. But just as they were in the middle of pulling it off, a few people started to get suspicious about what they were doing.
A handful of small journalists picked it up and wouldn't let it go.
That's James.
They just literally wouldn't let it go. Like a dog sinking his teeth into something, just not letting go. And I was like, uh-oh, this is the end of our professional lives.
And his fear was warranted. because the people he was fooling are perhaps the most intolerant people in America. They're the kind of folks that, if you cross them, they'll work to erase you from polite society. The build-up to James Lindsay's hoax is almost as interesting as the hoax itself. James is originally from upstate New York, but around 1984, when he was kindergarten age, his family moved to East Tennessee for work. His mother was an accountant, and his father was a chemical engineer.
And so it was kind of this funny thing, you know, we're in doing the kind of things in kindergarten that people do in kindergarten, and we're talking about different things, and the teacher doesn't know what to do with me because I'm like rattling off Newton's laws and things because my dad's like indoctrinating me into science, you know, from day one. We had the whole like how high can you count test, and they finally had to like stop me, and I got mad that they stopped me because I wasn't done yet.
Whether it was nature or nurture, at a very young age, James showed an aptitude for analytical thinking. By the time he reached his junior year of high school, he thought he'd study meteorology. He was really interested in weather.
But then I took physics in high school, and I was like, this is what I want to do. Physics is it.
So he enrolled in a local college, Tennessee Tech. He got a degree in physics.
And along the way, specifically when I took electricity and magnetism, I decided I do not like physics. This is not what I want to do.
So he began looking for a different field of study. He landed on mathematics.
Because I realized that what I actually liked in physics was the math. And so I just enjoy solving mathematical puzzles. And I really liked, once I started doing it and learning how to do it, doing mathematical proofs, I really liked that style of thinking.
A style of thinking based on concrete, provable facts. James got his master's, then entered the mathematics PhD program at the University of Tennessee. But all along the way, he noticed something changing in academia.
So the goal was, no matter what, is to keep students, keep their scholarships, keep whatever, you know, keep them, and don't fail anybody. And I was like, I teach math. I'm like, what are you talking about? Lots of kids can't do math, and they're going to fail, and they should not carry on to become college-educated people that can't do math. And they said, no. One student per semester, or per class, or whatever, can fail. One. And I was like, that's not going to work. That's definitely not going to work. And so I was like, I don't really want to be a part of this. I can't do the job that I want to do.
What James discovered was a phenomenon that crept into universities years earlier. I'd actually witnessed it myself in the early 90s. At the time, I was a professor's aide for a thermodynamics class. One day I was administering a midterm exam when I noticed that someone was cheating on the test. It was the only female in the class, and she was looking at a tiny crib sheet in her hand. I walked over to the professor and discreetly said, "Sir, that student is cheating. What should we do?" He looked at her, then back at me and said, "Nothing. We'll talk about it after class." I was confused. If we let her finish, she could just dispose of the evidence. But he insisted on letting it go. After class, he pulled me aside and said that the mechanical engineering department was getting pressure to admit more females. There was less than a handful in the entire program, and the cheater was the only female in this course. If we officially caught her, he explained, she'd be expelled, further reducing the number of women in the department. So the professor decided to let it slide. I was shocked. I mean, this wasn't some frivolous discipline like Chicano studies or feminism. Many of these students would go on to design products where life or death was at stake. If we let them cheat their way through these courses, the end result could be horrific. At the time, it troubled me to my core, and was one of the reasons why I left academia. This was what James Lindsay was witnessing some 15 years later.
I didn't know anything about the woke stuff that was happening or creeping in the university at the time. I didn't realize that that was one of the hooks by which the university would be snared into wokeness, which is that if they can't get rid of the most complaining students, those students are going to be able to direct the school one way or another. So the most fragile or agitated or upset 1% of students or 2% of students, the wokest 2%, who are constantly making their demands and throwing their fits about everything not being exactly the way they want it to be, gain outsized power if the university is absolutely willing to bend over backwards to keep them happy and keep them in.
One of the earliest public indications that wokeness had gotten a foothold in the sciences came while James was working towards his PhD.
In January 2005, Harvard President Lawrence H. Summers spoke at a conference focused on the topic of diversifying the science and engineering workforce. The goal of the gathering was for participants to address the cause behind the low number of women in high-level positions within science and engineering, and to potentially propose a solution. The discussion was supposed to be off the record, so that speakers could talk freely on the subject. In Larry Summers' speech, he proposed three primary factors that attributed to this phenomenon. The first was the role differences between men and women. He offered that, at a critical time early in their careers, men were willing to think about work for 80 hours a week, just as women were in their crucial childbearing years. The second factor he proposed was that men and women had innately different aptitudes for science and engineering at the higher levels of the field. And finally, he concluded that there was possibly a socialization culture that perhaps led to some discrimination against women. He ultimately concluded that women weren't in high-level positions within science and engineering primarily because of innate differences in interests and aptitude. Discrimination, in his estimation, played a minor role. Well, his conclusion led to a response that would eventually become the new norm. A media outrage championed by feminist activists masquerading as journalists. The Boston Globe ran a story highlighting one female biologist that stormed out of the speech claiming that if she hadn't left, she would have either blacked out or thrown up. TV reporters also took their jabs at the Harvard president's comments.
Lawrence Summers said the innate differences between men and women are one reason fewer women succeed in science and math careers. Summers says his remarks were made just to spur debate, but some academics say such thinking is a disservice to female students.
They turned to a local female science student for a response.
Taught from a young age that nothing could hold her back, Davis was surprised by the comments made by Harvard University's president.
I don't think that, your biological difference, your biological makeup makes a difference of what you turn out to be.
Larry Summers was painted as a misogynist. Harvard's faculty quickly passed a motion claiming they lacked confidence in his leadership. A year later, Summers resigned from the Harvard presidency. Many believed it was related to his speech. The Larry Summers affair showed wokeness was making its way into the sciences. Again, James Lindsay.
By the time I finished my PhD in 2010, I wanted to leave the university system pretty much completely.
He saw the writing on the wall. Something was changing in academia. He'd eventually leave the university system, but stayed connected to the community through participating in online discussion groups. And he started to notice the trend that Larry Summers experienced.
And people are getting accused primarily at the time. It was kind of like the pre-Me Too era. So everything was sexism. Everything was misogyny. It wasn't so much about race. Occasionally that would come up, but it was almost always sexism, misogyny, rape culture, blah, blah, blah.
James took notice. But it wasn't until he read an outrageously ridiculous 2016 academic paper that he decided that he had to address the problem of wokeness head on.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So while studying for his PhD in mathematics, James Lindsay began to see wokeness creep into the sciences in an alarming way. Professors were pressured to keep students within the math department that would otherwise be failing. By 2010, James wanted out of the university system altogether. He participated in online discussion groups within his field and began to see the wokeness trend there as well. Claims of sexism and misogyny were being thrown around with high frequency. James took note, but it wasn't until he read an outrageously ridiculous 2016 academic paper that he decided he wanted to address the problem of wokeness head on. The title of this academic paper was Glaciers, Gender, and Science, a Feminist Glaciology Framework for Global Environmental Change Research. Now keep in mind, glaciology is the technical study of glaciers. You know, those big, slow-moving ice and snow formations near Earth's north and south poles. James recalls the absurd positions expressed in the paper.
So the science of glaciology is intrinsically masculinist and sexist, and has to be revamped through feminist theory in order to overcome those biases. And the science itself, and maybe science more broadly, that they suggest is actually profoundly sexist and therefore not coming to the right kinds of conclusions. So I'm reading this thing and thinking it can't be real, but it's real.
It was published in a respected journal called Progress in Human Geography.
It's like one of the top ones in geography. And so I'm reading this And it's making arguments like that we have to include indigenous mythologies about glaciers. We have to start understanding that some glaciers are male and some are female, and that glaciers have sex with one another and under certain conditions, and that if you fry bacon fat too close to a glacier, it'll become mad and it'll do things. And then they took these indigenous findings, they report this in the paper, to a glaciologist and said, well, what do you think about these things? And the guy, they said in the paper, stared at them and then closed the door in their face. He didn't want to talk about it. And that was just proof that he was a masculinist, you know, patriarchal jerk, and that didn't want to expand the purview of the science. And then it gets worse, if you can believe it. So they start telling these stories about, like, some woman that she's a feminist and she's a painter, and she paints pictures of glaciers. And she says, well, you know, they look at photographs and satellite photographs and things like this of glaciers all the time, but they don't look at this woman's art. And they were like, well, it's because they're sexist. This glaciologists are sexist because they won't look at the paintings, but they'll look at satellite photos. And I'm like, holy smokes, what is this?
James muscled through reading the entire paper. His colleague, a philosophy professor at Portland State University named Peter Boghossian, picked up the article as well.
Peter read part of it and was like, this is too stupid. I can't deal with it.
They might have just forgotten about the study and moved on with their lives. But then a famous science journalist wrote about it.
A journalist by the name of Matt Ridley had written an article, and his exact phrasing was very close to, I still hold out that this is a hoax, talking about that particular paper.
Matt Ridley's comment reminded James and his colleague of a famous incident that occurred two decades earlier.
In 1996, an NYU physics professor named Alan Sokol noticed that academics within the social sciences and humanities fields were venturing into weird philosophies untethered from reality. Alan Sokol discussed the issue at the time.
But I'm a leftist in the old-fashioned sense that I think working people are getting a bum deal, and we should try to change that. So it seems to me the job of academic social scientists who call themselves leftists is to uncover some of the facts about how our economic and political system really operates and to discuss them publicly and see what we can do to propose constructive changes. But unfortunately, there's some segment of the so-called academic left that's gone off into very strange philosophies, French imports like deconstruction and post-structuralism, some homegrown American inventions like feminist standpoint epistemology, and they've lost contact with the real world.
So Alan Sokol thought he'd conduct an experiment. He wanted to see if a leading North American journal of cultural studies would publish an article that was, quote, liberally salted with nonsense, end quote. He surmised that to get into one of these journals, his paper would have to sound technically good while simultaneously flattering the editor's ideological predispositions. So he wrote an article entitled Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity, and he submitted it to an academic journal of postmodern cultural studies entitled Social Text. Sokol's article proposed that a form of gravity was a social construct. The paper was basically fancy-sounding nonsense, filled with technical jargon that fell right within the journal's political bias. To Sokol's astonishment, the Science Journal published his paper. This was not supposed to happen. Legitimate science journals require peer review, a process that claims to be intellectually rigorous to ensure published articles meet a high threshold of quality. Sokol's experiment revealed that some cultural studies journals likely had zero critical review of their articles. This peer review process is an extremely important aspect of not only science journals, but of a functioning society at large because it forms our pool of knowledge. Again, James Lindsay.
So the way that peer review is supposed to work is, so I do some kind of research or whatever, and I want to publish that research, and I want it to be considered serious by professionals in the field. I submit the paper that I want to have published that I write as a result of that research. to an academic journal. The editors, who are also professionals in the field, but not necessarily highly specific experts, will read over the paper. If they think it's probably good enough to go further, they will send it off to some number of peer reviewers, usually 2, 3, or 4. And so the idea is, well, let's have other professionals in the field look at it before we publish it and decide, is it strong enough? Is it crazy?
These peer reviewers read it and typically propose corrections, point out weaknesses, ask if the author has considered a particular perspective, and so on.
And they will deliver back a series of comments. And if the peer reviewers are happy enough, and they will send a recommendation along with all of those corrections to the journal editor.
And the journal editor will then make a decision to either work towards publishing the paper or politely pass on it.
And so you can see that it's supposed to be a filtering mechanism that keeps junk research out. The problem is that if there are fashionable conclusions, for example, and like in the thing that you mentioned where, well, there's a pressure that we were really trying to keep women in engineering. If there's some pressure that's other than the actual academic quality, that pressure can capture the peer reviewers and the journal editors and the researchers working in the field, and they can actually just be kind of wandering down this path toward nonsense, toward some political agenda, as opposed to, for example, getting rigorous research on whatever the particular subject is.
And this corrupted peer review process can have grave cultural consequences, because if a politically soaked, unscientific research paper gets published, it becomes part of our pool of knowledge. Policymakers then use them to create public policy. Right around the time that James Lindsay read the Ridiculous Feminist Glacier Study, a segment of American society was tragically suffering from public policy based on flawed academic research, and it was destroying people's lives.
In 2007, a campus sexual assault study funded by the Justice Department was released. 3 years later, NPR and the Center for Public Integrity, both far-left media organizations, used this report to publish their own study entitled Sexual Assault on Campus. In the report, they referenced the 2007 study and made a shocking claim, stating, quote, "According to a report funded by the Department of Justice, roughly 1 in 5 women who attend college will become the victim of a rape or an attempted rape by the time she graduates," end quote. 1 in 5. NPR then took their report to the U.S. Department of Education and got the Assistant Secretary of Civil Rights within that department to make a public promise.
"We will use all of the tools at our disposal, including referring to justice or withholding federal funds, to ensure that women are free from sexual violence."
Again, James Lindsay.
The next thing you know, you have the White House issuing a Dear Colleague letter, Obama coming out and talking about this rape epidemic on campus.
"We're here to talk today about an issue that is a priority for me, and that's ending campus sexual assault. This is a problem that matters to all of us. An estimated 1 in 5 women has been sexually assaulted during her college years. 1 in 5.
The problem was that everyone that was citing the 2007 sexual assault study, including Obama, were citing it incorrectly. The 1 in 5 meme was so widespread that even the researchers of the original study expressed concern that their conclusions were being misrepresented. The researchers only surveyed 2 schools, meaning their study wasn't meant to represent a national trend. Also, critics argued that the 2007 methodology was highly flawed, and it should have been obvious. A U.S. Department of Justice study done just 7 years earlier reported that 2.8% of college women had either experienced rape or attempted rape over the 4 preceding years. If people were to believe the NPR report, they'd have to believe that the sexual assault of college women had gotten over 7 times worse in just 7 years, when the national incidence of rape and sexual assault were drastically decreasing over the same time. As critics dug into the 2007 report, they learned that the study used an anonymous online questionnaire that resulted in a very low response rate. Some credibly argued that the overwhelming majority that didn't respond likely had no experience with sexual assault. If the numbers were included, critics claimed, the assault numbers would have been a fraction of what the study reported. Also, the assault number included unwanted kissing and groping, actions that technically met the definition of battery but hardly qualified as attempted rape, as the NPR report claimed. At a minimum, the 1 in 5 sexual assault meme was highly inflated. But that didn't matter, the narrative stuck. Again, James Lindsay.
And then this claim was then put to politically actionable uses. It was a disaster through the early 2010s for, say, Title IX kangaroo courts, as they got called, and Title IX inquisitions.
Title IX is a federal law that, among other things, allows colleges to bypass the bedrock American legal doctrine of due process in cases involving claims of sexual assault, and replaces that doctrine with what could be called a guilty until proven innocent approach. When these sexual assault research papers surfaced, it gave feminist activists the academic credibility to force colleges to deal with the so-called campus rape culture with an iron fist.
All of a sudden, you know, the administrations at these colleges went on witch hunts and destroyed a few women, but mostly men's lives in response to false things. And it just absolutely, you know, undermined due process, undermined constitutional protections that citizens have, and created a nightmare.
In one instance, just a few weeks after Obama's rape culture speech in 2014, Rolling Stone published a bombshell exposé. In it, a female student from the University of Virginia claimed that she was violently gang raped at a fraternity party. The story was too good for the media to pass up.
One of the most elite universities in the country is under the microscope after a Rolling Stone article painted a picture of rampant sexual assault on campus and inaction by university officials.
Quote from the article, "Grab its leg," she heard a voice say, and that's when Jackie knew she was going to be raped. She remembers every moment of the next 3 hours of agony, during which she says seven men took turns raping her.
This is the fraternity where the most violent of those alleged sexual assaults took place, the Phi Kappa Psi house here. And this graphic article from Rolling Stone has sparked outrage and backlash across campus about the college community, and more specifically, the administration's handling of sexual assault on campus.
The University of Virginia has suspended all fraternities for the rest of the year following allegations of sexual assault at one fraternity. It's the latest in a string of incidents involving Greek life at campuses nationwide.
I think the Greek community needs to do some serious soul searching about the way that it has behaved, about the behavior it's tolerated, about what its future is going to be.
And I'm really, really, really furious at the culture of rape and the complete inaction of the administration and the complete complacency of the student body.
The Rolling Stone article quoted the 1 in 5 meme, stating, quote, 1 in 5 women is sexually assaulted in college, though only 12% report it to police, end quote. The writer took to the media to proclaim that the University of Virginia was just the tip of the feminist glacier.
I was told that University of Virginia is actually quite typical, even though the things that I discovered at University of Virginia are really horrifying. What I was told is that really what happens at UVA is probably fairly normal at a college campus.
The Rolling Stone story was everywhere. Corporate media rallied against rape culture and the misogyny of fraternities and universities that enabled it. The only problem was, key details of the victim's story crumbled under scrutiny.
Rolling Stone is now dealing with blowback from all sides as the magazine changes its story following its sweeping expose of an alleged gang rape at the University of Virginia fraternity house there.
Law enforcement couldn't verify the alleged victim Jackie's story. In fact, what they did verify was that the party she claimed to be gang raped at didn't happen. The Columbia Journalism Review did a forensic investigation on the story and concluded that the article was a product of failed methodology. 5 months after publishing the article, Rolling Stone retracted the story and pulled it down from their site. The dean of UVA filed and won a defamation lawsuit against the magazine and the author of the article. It later came out that Jackie had become obsessed with another male student and made up key elements of the story to gain his pity.
The entire rape culture, public policy, and witch hunt was given academic credibility from a paper with an imprecise research method. Very serious ramifications come from these flawed academic studies. So when James Lindsay and his colleague Peter Boghossian saw the feminist glaciology paper in 2016, it triggered an idea.
We saw something that was there that the woke had done that we decided is like, okay, that's enough. That's too far.
James' colleague Peter came up with a way to expose these science journals.
And there's all these articles that are published in the academic literature that people think are knowledge, but in fact, they're just opinion. They're just prejudices and opinion. The best way to discredit that isn't to argue against it, but rather to expose it for what it is by pulling a joke on it. showing that people can't tell the difference that are producing this stuff between something real and something obviously farcical. We knew who Alan Sokol was. Peter was actually friends with Alan Sokol. Alan Sokol famously did a hoax paper on a journal called Social Text in the 1990s, where he said that gravity is a social construction and like just wrote all this postmodern gobbledygook, and they accepted it. And so Peter was like, these people are ripe for another hoax. They didn't learn their lesson.
They decided to commit at least a year on their hoax. But little did they know how much their lives would change when all was said and done. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So after James Lindsay and his colleague Peter Boghossian read a ridiculous academic paper about infusing glacier science with feminism, the two decided the peer-reviewed science journals were broken and needed to be taught a lesson. They began researching the origins of the words and ideas littering these pseudoscience academic papers and eventually found which disciplines were pumping them out.
We narrowed in on the gender studies academic literature and the feminist theory academic literature. And we started to read some of this literature and we're like, this stuff's crazy. And so we thought it'd be fun to write an academic hoax. Just thought it would be fun. So we wrote an academic hoax carrying the title, The Conceptual Penis as a Social Construct. And we argued that penises are best thought of as a social construct rather than as anatomical organs, and that they cause all of our problems, especially climate change.
They argued that manspreading, the complaint that men sit with their legs spread apart, was, quote, akin to raping the empty space around him, end quote. In May 2017, a science journal called Cogent Social Sciences published the paper. Shortly after, James and his colleague Peter admitted to the stunt and basically proclaimed they'd proven the farcical nature of gender studies scholarship. But their critics shot back, saying they'd missed the mark. They claimed that the journal that published their paper was a pay-to-publish journal that regularly publishes terrible papers. In the eyes of gender studies supporters, their prank proved nothing. James and Peter had spiked the football too soon. But what their critics hadn't realized was that they were providing James and Peter a how-to guide on the most effective way to pull off their hoax. James recalls what his critics were telling him.
If you wanted to prove your point, this is what you would have had to have done. And we said, okay, there's a roadmap. Let's do it again.
On August 16th, 2017, they officially started their second attempt at the prank. A few weeks later, they enlisted Helen Pluckrose, a British cultural and political writer. The three created fake author names and got to writing hoax research papers. The first six they wrote were rejected by science journals. They hadn't yet figured out the secret sauce to getting their research papers accepted. So by late November 2017, they regrouped and dug in deeper into the scholarship in what they called grievance studies, which includes feminist studies, women and gender studies, race studies, sexuality studies, queer studies, fat studies, cultural studies, and sociology. The grievance scholarship may look ridiculous to the outside world, but within these fields of study, they play by a set of rules. The pranksters needed to make a commitment to figure them out. Within a few months, they began to understand the rules, and that's when the trio started to have some success. By March 2018, two papers were accepted. By June 2018, a third was accepted. Again, James Lindsay.
There were three that stand out.
In one paper, they rewrote a section of Hitler's Mein Kampf by replacing Hitler's movement with intersectional feminism.
And then just created this whole new idea that we called solidarity feminism, and literally just rewrote Hitler's words with an 8-point plan and the whole thing to create a new kind of feminism that completely throws out the idea that women should be able to choose how they represent themselves or be feminist or what it means to be a woman or be feminist. No, it has to be intersectional solidarity, no half measures, blah, 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 whole thing. So we rewrote a chapter of Mein Kampf, and a feminist social work journal accepted that for publication. A second paper that was accepted that got a rather lot of attention was that we claimed that the sport of professional bodybuilding is intrinsically fatphobic because it only cares about big bodies that are built with muscles rather than big bodies built with fat. And so as a result, there must be a new category added, a new competition category added to professional bodybuilding as a sport called fat bodybuilding. And fat bodybuilding it can't be a competition because they're against competition. So it's actually an exhibition where everybody wins, but you get up on stage and you wear fat-tion of your choice and exhibit your fat to the audience. And the more politicized your fat exhibition is, in kind of a queer theory sort of way, where it intersects with fat studies, the better. And so that would be required for professional bodybuilding to continue as a sport, because, you know, the privileging of muscle over fat is just fat exclusionary. And so, you know, we titled that paper, Who Are They to Judge?
They did get some feedback from the peer reviewers.
We actually said that it was the final frontier for fat. Turns out Peter is a fan of Star Trek rather significantly, so he thought it'd be fun to put like a little Star Trek, you know, the final frontier allusion in there. And they were like, the word final indicates that there's an end point to fat activism, which there's not. So you can't use the word final. And then the word frontier evokes memories of the genocide of Native Americans, so choose a different word. So we couldn't call it the final frontier for fat activism anymore. We had to change that.
But the one that got the most attention was a research paper about dog sex.
So what we claimed was that you can use the way that people react to dogs humping each other at dog parks as kind of an implicit bias test to determine how they feel about rape. And so we claimed that we, as a feminist researcher, went to dog parks and observed nearly 10,000 dogs, which there are not 10,000 dogs in any given dog park in the course of a year, but there's like 40 maybe, because it's like a neighborhood. But anyway, we said we observed 10,000 dogs and hundreds or thousands of incidents between dogs, and just made up all these fake numbers about how the dogs behave. But what we were interested in was how the owners reacted if it was a male on female dog rape versus a male on male dog rape. And we then said that this proves that dog parks are petri dishes of canine rape culture, and that people are accepting of this, particularly when it's straight dog rape. And so men in particular are big fans of straight dog rape, get her, you know, kind of attitude, cheering the dog on. And that this proved that obviously that the dog parks and also human nightclubs are rape condoning spaces. And rape culture is out of control. And so what we should do is train men the way that we train dogs, literally leashes, shock collars, things like that, in order to overcome rape culture. And however stupid you think the paper is, like, I just made it sound really, really smart and great. It's really worse than that. It's the dumbest thing that's probably ever been written. And not only was that accepted by the leading feminist geography journal, it was actually held up as exemplary scholarship in the field of feminist geography, given an award for excellence in scholarship.
James couldn't believe they'd gotten these ludicrous research papers accepted. Things were going along swimmingly, but as they plugged away, trouble was brewing.
So what ended up breaking the whole thing open was that the dog park paper, the dog sex paper, got out there and they published it, and it was out in the world, and we weren't done. We were still writing other papers, and people noticed. It's insane. There was an account on Twitter, I don't know if it still exists, it was called Real Peer Review, that was actually chronicling these ridiculous papers that come out, and they found the dog park paper.
Real Peer Review tweeted it out, and indie journalists immediately began picking it up.
The degree of insanity of that paper is literally the highest of all of them that got accepted. But once that hit, like, it was article after article after article. The articles just kept coming and kept coming, and the stress was mounting and mounting and mounting.
At the time, they'd only had 3 papers accepted. If journalists kept digging, they would discover their experiment before James and his team had a critical number of ridiculous research papers accepted to make an impact.
And so, you know, we had a lot on the line that we're going to lose all of this. You know, we're going to get embarrassed. We're going to be shut down. It's not going to have the necessary intended effect unless we can, you know, hopefully get more papers through.
As the articles on the dog park paper piled up, they tried to ignore the journalist, hoping to get more of their ridiculous woke research published.
So we were like, keep your head down, keep your head down, keep your head down, keep your head down. And the dog park paper was so insane that a handful of small journalists picked it up and wouldn't let it go. They just literally wouldn't let it go. Like a dog sinking his teeth into something, just not letting go.
The journalists tried reaching out to Helen Wilson, the fake author for the dog park paper. Their inquiry landed in James's inbox. He and his colleagues ignored the emails, hoping it would buy them enough time to get more of their papers published. But that's when the journalists got smart. They decided to pull in one of the biggest media outfits in America to help apply pressure. And a journalist from that outlet began digging in.
And then all of a sudden, the email came from the Wall Street Journal.
From a reporter named Jillian K. Melcher.
I was like, oh no, this is too big. This isn't like campus reform. I can ignore them. This isn't like one of those. This is the Wall Street Journal. And I was like, we're not going to get away with lying to the Wall Street Journal. And then boom, the other email comes from the journal.
The science journal that published their dog sex paper.
So then the journal contacts us and is like, what's going on? Who are you really? You know, can you prove your identity so we can get these people off our backs? And I was like, uh-oh.
Right before the Science Journal and the Wall Street Journal called James, he and his team thought they had at least 5 more months to get the critical number of papers accepted.
And we suddenly had days or weeks with it being unclear what the finish line was going to be. And so incredibly stressful that this huge project that could essentially detonate our lives if it goes wrong had just left our control very suddenly, very, very unexpectedly. And not exactly in circumstances that were fortuitous. We were like, this is the end of our professional lives. And now the journal is on us. The Wall Street Journal is on us. And it's like, all right, we got to come clean. So I emailed Jillian at the Wall Street Journal. I emailed her back and I said, okay, this is Helen Wilson,
the fake author of the dog park paper.
And I will talk to you on the phone about what's going on tomorrow. Off record. And then we had this whole argument about whether or not the call could be off record or on record when we first started the call. But eventually she agreed and said it'll be off record, or at least some of it would be. And then I told her what was going on. The first thing she called and I answered, and I don't sound like somebody named Helen. And so she was like, are you trans? And I was like, no, that's not the scandal here. I'm just a man, and my name is James. And so I just started going through the whole thing with her, and she's like, oh my God. I think she saw a possible Pulitzer in her eyes or something at this moment. And so we talked for like an hour.
James and his team knew they couldn't ask the Wall Street Journal to hold the story. They're a financial outlet. They'd never agree to it. They had to find another way to hold up the publication until more of their papers were accepted. So they decided on a two-pronged plan. First, keep the Wall Street Journal busy with the flood of information that they'd have to thoroughly check, and then leave holes in the story that they'd have to slowly find and need to resolve.
That bought us a couple of months to get our affairs in order.
In that time, James and his team got 7 of their ridiculous woke papers accepted and had 7 more studies in various stages of being approved. On October 2nd, 2018, just as the Wall Street Journal released their story on their hoax, James and his team released a video describing what they'd done.
Since approximately June of 2017, I, along with 2 other concerned academics, Peter Boghossian and Helen Pluckrose, have been writing intentionally broken academic papers and submitting them to highly respected journals in fields that study gender, race, sexuality, and similar topics.
The story exploded across the globe.
I think we were on the front page of over 400 newspapers worldwide.
They had unequivocally proven their point. The scholarship of these woke academic fields were anything but scholarship. It was largely a pile of gobbledygook, masquerading as knowledge.
James Lindsay and his colleague Helen Pluckrose wrote a book about their experiment entitled Cynical Theories, and are now 2 of the leading thinkers on the phenomenon of wokeness. Their colleague Peter Boghossian joins them in that status. But as a result of working on the grievance studies affair, as it's come to be known, he's faced some serious consequences. In 2018, his employer, Portland State University, initiated an investigation into whether he'd violated ethical guidelines by conducting research on human subjects without their approval. Many leading academics saw the move as retaliation for the academic establishment being embarrassed. Peter's defenders included famed evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, psychologist Steven Pinker, philosopher Daniel Dennett, and psychologist Jordan Peterson. Later in 2018, the university ruled that Peter had indeed violated ethical research guidelines. In 2021, he resigned his position at Portland State University, claiming that it had become a social justice factory. Which brings us back to the question, is wokeness ridiculous or dangerous? The answer is both. Wokeness may be absurd, but it is not benign. Wokeness is profoundly dangerous because it has the potential to unravel society. Woke academics in the fields of cultural studies and the humanities publish politically soaked research based on junk science. Woke activists then use these broken studies to force politicians to make disastrous public policies based on these flawed findings. After the Rolling Stone's heralded sexual assault article fell apart, the college rape culture narrative looked like it was on the ropes. But then a few months after the article was retracted, a new academic paper was released that upped the ante. It was no longer 1 in 5. The academic community now claimed nearly 1 in 4 college females are raped or sexually assaulted.
The paper was blowing it out by a factor of 10 to 1 at least versus what's really going on, because they were ideologically captured enough to want to be able to make this claim. And then this claim was then put to politically actionable uses.
James Lindsay thinks he understands why his team's hoax research made it through the peer review process.
I think that it's working the way it's supposed to.
In other words, the peer review process within certain disciplines is designed to give academic credibility to dangerous political causes. That's why wokeness is dangerous. It will not be removed without a fight. But a fight we must commence. Because if wokeness isn't removed from American institutions, the evil these cult-like activists spew will continue to break down society as we know it.
A lot of people, when they hear the term pedophile, they automatically assume that it means a sex offender. And that isn't true, and it leads to a lot of misconceptions about attractions toward minors.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Thanks for listening.